Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with religion journalist and author Christine Wicker. Christine Wicker is the author of the new book, The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. During her 17 years at the Dallas Morning News, Christine Wicker was a feature writer, columnist, and religion reporter. She's also author of several books, including the highly acclaimed New York Times bestseller, Lilydale, The True Story of the Town That Talks to the Dead. Christine Wicker was raised in Oklahoma, Texas, and other parts of the South. Her mother's grandfather was an itinerant Baptist preacher, and her dad's father was a Kentucky coal miner. Again, the new book is The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency, and we welcome Christine Wicker to the program today. Christine Wicker, delighted to have you here. How are you?
I'm good. We're getting a little cold weather in Texas, which is nice, or cool.
Cool.
So, I'm good.
Christine Wicker, there's religion in your background. Are you a religious person?
Well, I am. My grandmother took me up to the Baptist church, walked there with me in her arms when I was an infant, and dedicated me to the Lord. And I've tried to get away from that, but seems to have taken. I don't know if I'm dedicated to the Lord, but I do go to a Baptist church, not a Southern Baptist church. I recently rejoined. I was raised an evangelical Christian.
And just because I'm a devil myself, I want to ask you, we know that President Trump has been reliant on the evangelical community. Are you one of those people who support President Trump?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, I think President Trump is the worst thing to happen to Christianity, maybe in my lifetime, because that kind of far-right evangelical Christian, I wouldn't even call myself an evangelical, I don't think, has really dominated the public square. So for people outside Christianity, and there are more and more of those every day, that far right kind of Christianity is the only one they really know. They think that's Christianity as a whole. And so now those people, in voting for Trump, have violated the last vestiges of their moral position. It leaves people outside who don't know a lot about Christianity and don't know about the rest of us because we're hardly ever covered, thinking that Christianity is utterly bankrupt. Who needs it?
Okay, so I got a question for you.
Okay.
Why? In other words, this guy, as we know, bragged on a tape about being a grabber of women's genitals, and that's how, and they like it, and that's what you want to do. Isn't that offensive to evangelicals?
I think it is offensive to evangelicals, but what has happened in this country is that it began with FDR, is that nationalism and Christianity have been paired in a really unholy partnership that was begun by people who opposed FDR, business people, moneyed people, who couldn't seem to shake the American people from their loyalty to him. And so they tried selfishness, and it didn't work. Self-interest didn't work. And then some of the ministers came up with the idea that they could say that Christianity was a choice, and so was capitalism, free enterprise. And so they were the same. As one of the scholars, Kevin Krause, says, in Christianity, if you're good, you go to heaven. If you're bad, you go to hell. In capitalism, if you're good, you make a profit. And if you're bad, you fail. And when you put those economic ideas together with Christianity, which I think is a horror, a travesty of all that Christianity is truly about, you have something that's very appealing to Americans. And I think that has caused evangelicals in their support of republicanism to become very confused. I also think that the so-called evangelical vote is not all evangelical. It's really those people in the South and the Midwest who say they are evangelicals, which in those cultures is the default position. That's just what you say. It's the safest thing to say. What you really have is the Southern vote. And as you know, and your reader and your listeners know, the Southern bloc, the Southern vote, has always been racist, looking to the past, very conservative and a problem for progressives, for Democrats and Republicans, both when they are in their progressive modes. But for most of my adult lifetime, that group of evangelicals and the Southern Bloc has been solidly Republican.
Now, that's interesting that you say that, because I'm much, much, much older than you are. And I want to talk to you a little bit about somebody who modeled himself, I believe, after Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a hero in my home. And that is LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson. You know,
yes.
People think he was competing with Kennedy. There are others who think he was competing with Roosevelt. He wanted to make the same impression, and that's where Medicare and everything else, Medicaid, came from. But when he gave his We Shall Overcome speech, he turned around allegedly to people and said, "There goes the South." Is that right, do you think?
Absolutely. You know, LBJ was such a rascal and such a great politician. But when Roosevelt died, he said he was like a daddy to me, which makes Texans laugh because, you know, LBJ, he just so wily. But yes, I think absolutely. LBJ saw his chance to make a difference, and he did it.
But even though he recognized, as you have posited with us, that the Southern vote would desert the Democratic Party.
Absolutely. And the Southern vote kept FDR from doing all that he could have done. The fact that he had gone to Georgia, to Warm Springs, and considered that his second home did help him enormously. And in his first election, of course, the South was really with him because the South was worse off than a whole lot of other places. Texas was with him, too. So was Oklahoma because of the Dust Bowl. So, you know, they were on their knees. And FDR rescued them. Now, later, once they got off their knees, they began to fight him also. But FDR always knew that the strength of the Democratic Party came from holding the South. And so he always had to temper what he did. You know, he wouldn't come out publicly against lynching for that reason. He couldn't do it. But what he did do, that a lot of people don't know, is he caused the Justice Department to begin civil rights investigations. And it was those things that really eventually ended lynching.
Okay, so let's go to your very good book, The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. I want to remind people you're Christine Wicker. So, Christine, if I may call you that, the question is this. Was FDR a Christian?
He was a Christian from birth. He was baptized in the Episcopal Church. He was raised in the Episcopal Church. His parents went every Sunday. They were quite devout. And he went to school that was headed by an Episcopal minister. He went to chapel every day for 4 years. He had theological training. He was confirmed as a teenager. Yes, and he continued that. Now, he didn't go to church like some people wanted him to, Eleanor and his mother, to name two. But I think that those precepts had been really implanted in his heart, and I believe that they were always there. But when he had polio, what's very interesting is that Eleanor and Frances Perkins, his Secretary of Labor, the first woman ever to serve in a presidential cabinet, both say that he had a crisis of faith. And he seemed to have come out of that crisis by deciding that God had set this up as a test for him. And he took it on as a spiritual test. Then I believe what happened is when he went to Warm Springs, this was his closest time with the American people and certainly with people in the Deep South. He met people at a level that he had never encountered before. And he became, I don't want to overstate this because he would never have called him a messiah figure, but he was something like that to people who had polio throughout the country. He began to teach them. He called himself Doc Roosevelt, the old Doc, he would say. And I think that as he began to do that, his own spirituality began to grow, and his own vision of who he could be and his understanding of what the country needed began to grow. And, you know, the thing about being religious, and this is one of the many reasons why I think historians have not really dealt in depth with his spirituality, is that it is intertwined with all the rest of your life. It isn't a separate thing. It gets built through your life, too.
You said something that really caught my attention. So did he have, as so many politicians have in the past, what we might call a Jesus complex? Did he think that he was the Messiah?
He was a very confident man. We might even call him an arrogant man. We might call him an egotistical man. Yeah, we might say that nobody gets to be president without a really large ego and a large vision of themselves. And he did have that. The people who knew him best, and one of them would be his secretary, said no, he was far too humble to ever have a messianic complex, but he definitely felt called. There's a difference in that many people of faith, of all faiths, may feel called to join God in partnership. I think he felt as though God expected him to do what he could, and he could become president. And once he became president, God expected him to serve those who had too little. There's plenty of evidence of that.
One of his heroes was a man named Peabody. Could you tell us about him?
Yes, he was at Groton. He was the headmaster at Groton. And he was a man of stalwart faith. And he made Groton a place that was almost, in the words of one person, absurdly pure. He talked about the scripture all the time. And he reinforced this idea that Roosevelt already had, that those who had much were expected to do much and expected to serve people. Now, many people have said, well, what that was noblesse oblige, and, you know, not Christianity at all, just a kind of condescending to those who were less. But it was more than that. And you find out that it was more than that because you see him quoting scripture in many ways over and over again from his inaugural speech on. And to me, there are two factors that are really important in the idea that FDR was a Christian. And one is what that sense of being called, having a certain destiny that a lot of people have who aren't all that Christian, but they will think that God means for them to succeed. And whether God means it or not, whether there is a God or not, that empowers people. And certainly that idea of being called, that idea that he was working with God, was important to FDR, and it strengthened him. Eleanor thought it was why he had the determination and the confidence and the ability to act so decisively. And the other thing is that it gives people a vision of what could be. Roosevelt had, sometimes it was laughable. I couldn't believe how many things I was able to find that he would say about what America was becoming. You have to think, this came right out of the kingdom. I mean, nobody would say. He would say things like, America is becoming a place where hard-headedness will no longer be an excuse for hard-heartedness. Well, it hasn't become that yet. It's rather amazing that anyone would even think that. But he had this vision and this certainty that it could be done. He believed that out of religion came freedom of speech, the idea that we could be equal. So for him, that was the foundation of all that America is in the world.
So let me ask you a question. There's fairly good discussion about his womanizing with his cousin, with his secretaries. Is that the mark of a good Christian?
No, but I will tell you that I was in a group of Christians the other day, and in the introduction, in introducing me, this minister says, well, everybody knows that FDR couldn't be a Christian because he committed adultery, and the whole room just erupted in laughter. And the preacher says, should we have a show of hands here? Christians are called to be so much better than they are. So, no. I would say, and I say in the book, that FDR was not a perfect Christian. Oh my gosh, not at all. But he was an effective one.
The book is The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. And we are speaking to Christine Wicker, the author. So, Christine, you mentioned Eleanor Roosevelt. You mentioned her role in religion. I've never thought of her as that kind of, I've always thought of her as a hero and a principled individual and a feminist, of course. But I've never thought of her as a Christian woman as much as Sarah, the mother. Where did I go wrong?
I don't think you did at all. Eleanor's way of thinking about morality appeared to be different than Franklin's. Certainly, she pushed him to be the very best man he could be, and she wanted him to go much farther than he did go. Eleanor had her doubts. She was a more questioning Christian, and according to how most of us look at religion, she would have been the deeper thinker about spiritual matters. She once asked him whether their children should be given the same kind of education that they were in the church, since so much of that seemed not to be true, and should they be taught the Bible literally, sort of, they're having this discussion. And he says, of course, there are some things, you know, that we just don't really even need to think about or question. In fact, the simple faith of FDR, the title of the book, really comes from her having described his faith somewhat sardonically as simple. As far as we know, he took the Bible literally. He didn't care a thing about theology. In fact, some people have even said his faith was just really childish. Now, that could be true, and that's very interesting to me, because if he took it literally, then that would mean that very good things can come out of a literal, unquestioning faith. On the other hand, FDR couldn't have been as simple as people seem to think he was, and do as much as he did and think as well as he did. He was also really good at cutting to the core of things. He knew that what he was to do is preserve freedom of religion in this country. He tried to make peace a number of times with Hitler and Mussolini. He entreated them to make peace. He really, in my opinion, hewed to the most difficult and the most basic level of what Jesus taught, which is we are to help those who need our help. We are to be brothers to one another.
Let's pursue that for a moment, Christine Wicker. And the question would be, how ecumenical was the guy? In other words, we've been talking about his Christianity. I'm Jewish. My family worshipped FDR. My twin brother was in a conversation once with a major politician in the South who said to him, "Tell me about yourself." And he said, well, and he went on about how his parents worshipped FDR, his Jewish parents worshipped FDR, and thought, in fact, that he might be Jewish. Because, you know, there was a lot of anti-Semitism surrounding Roosevelt, as you know, Rosenfeld and all the rest of it. And this lady, politician, turned around to him and said, "That's funny, Lewis, that's what my parents thought, too." And she was anything but Jewish. So it was... It was quite a shot. So what about his ecumenical traction, clearly to the Jews, clearly to black people, although that within the same religious Christian tradition in America? What do you make of that?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I had to talk about Christianity specifically because that's where he came from and that was his background. But FDR, he wasn't narrow in any way. He was very ecumenical and, in fact, was the president who was most responsible for popularizing the idea that we come from a Judeo-Christian heritage instead of just a Christian heritage. He brought more Jews into his administration than anybody else ever had. He was very opposed to anti-Semitism. As you know, he's also been accused of not doing all that he could have done for the Jews. So, in this matter, as in many others, there's some controversy. It's always hard to know about FDR because he wasn't a man who went around emoting. You know, he was very much lockjaw, upper-class Easterner. And so to talk a lot about your feelings and to talk a lot about religion, you know, in a sort of emotional way would have just seemed to him to be in such bad taste. So he didn't do that. He mainly really wanted, he really believed people ought to believe in God. But if you didn't, that didn't make him dislike you. That didn't make him ostracize you. If you were Jewish, he thought that you were in the same tradition that he was and that you supported the same things. And as you know from looking at the book, what's really interesting to me is that you have Hitler and FDR then sort of squaring off, because FDR never cared for Hitler, and Hitler wanted to destroy the Jews primarily because of their moral ideas. Primarily because they wanted to help the weak. They were the ones who came up with this whole idea. And Hitler just thought, if you can't get rid of the Jews, you can't get rid of this idea. And he thought that really threatened humanity because he believed in survival of the fittest. And he thought if you let these weaklings, if you had mercy and compassion as the Jews had taught the whole world to have, then you were endangering humanity. And then here comes Roosevelt with what some people call derisively his Jew deal, and his allies who were Jewish, and his precepts, his moral grounding that came from the Jewish faith and the Christian faith. And he's in direct opposition to Hitler. So it's a fascinating little standoff there.
Let's go to another opponent, and that is Huey Long. Now, you have talked to us about the South and, you know, why FDR thought the South was so important to his presidency and his electoral presidency. Tell us a little about his relationship to Long, because, you know, there were people who posited that maybe FDR had something to do with his assassination. I don't believe that for a second, but there were people who thought it.
Well, and you can see why, because Long was a formidable opponent. He was a supporter of FDR, but he also was building a lot of support in the South and adopting policies that were far more radical than the ones that FDR was adopting. You know, FDR really was not that radical. He was a pretty conservative guy, but he knew what he wanted to do. He knew what he thought God required of him. And so Huey Long's death was, you know, a good thing for Roosevelt's political career. It eliminated an opponent who was quite dangerous to him.
And dangerous because, of course, he was a populist, as well as, to some degree, to the left of FDR. Let me ask you, Christine Wicker, about words. Every president says, "I'm a Christian," right? I mean, The early presidents were sort of deists, but later on, everybody said, you know, Trump goes to church occasionally, and one could argue that case. I would. So basically, how do you, as a journalist, how do you, as an author, get over the idea, you know, that part of getting elected in the United States is to announce your Christianity?
Well, absolutely. And that's part of the reason the things that FDR said, the way that he used the presidency, the bully pulpit of the presidency, to deliver sermons to the American people was extreme. And when you start looking at what he did and how often he did it, you're just stunned by how strong that was. But if it were only words, and in fact, some people have said he didn't even write those words. It was his speech makers. But the speech makers all said, speech writers all said, no, it was not us. It was FDR. So that has kind of been debunked.
I don't know that I agree with that. And here's why. You know, I asked Ted Sorensen once, did you write Profiles in Courage? A lot of people think he did, you know, by the way. They always say no. It was the other guy. Or I'm not going to answer that question. So I don't know that it's debunking by saying that somebody deferred and said, no, it was the president's words.
Oh, okay. That's a very good question, because of course they would, especially Louis Howe.
Yeah.
And I address that in the book. When Louis Howe says, oh, no, the boss never wrote that. Well, you know that Louis Howe would say anything. And he was so political that he knew exactly what to say. But there are minute descriptions of how they went about putting together those speeches in which they say, you know, he would go through line by line and we would work all night, and then he would look at the speech again in the day, in the morning, and cross out things and put other things in. The other thing was that people said, well, Roosevelt couldn't have written those because he didn't know the Bible so well. Well, he probably knew the Bible far better than they did, because he'd listened to way more sermons. He'd gone to chapel. Peabody, who you asked about, was such a staunch Christian. I mean, he just never shut up about it. So he did know the Bible, but would they have protected him? Would they have said that? Yeah. They make a convincing case if you read it, but you could also say whatever they put in those speeches, every speechwriter is there to represent the president, to be the mouthpiece for the president. So if he hadn't wanted them to say those things, they wouldn't have. But the other thing is, and this is what really convinces me, is it's what he did. You know, what someone says, the test of any religion is what people do, not just what they say. Mm. And when you look at what he did, as say, opposed to what Hoover did, who was also a religious man, a well-intentioned man, a hero of humanity. Mm. But Hoover cared as I think the evangelical Christians today do, they cared about a civil religion tenet that's very strong in America, and that is that we're supposed to earn our way into prosperity. And I think that's really very, very important, because that's a religious tenet in American civil religion. Hoover believed that we had to have that for the country to prosper, and so did Roosevelt. But Roosevelt just didn't think that you had to. He used to say, I believe in property rights. I just believe that property should serve humans, not humans should serve property.
I think that's right, because Roosevelt knew that the society would collapse if you didn't allow people to live in their own homes and make that easy enough to do and all the rest.
Right.
I want to go Christine Wicker, the author of The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. I want to go to some of his other imperfections, which you were talking about. Now, one of the major ones, which we have all learned about again and again and again and read about, you know, is his desire to marry Lucy Mercer and divorce Eleanor and Sarah, the mother, who was no great friend early on with Eleanor, I suspect. Coming in and say, you do that, you're disinherited. Let's talk about that, if we can. Does that impinge on religion at all, that series of factoids?
Oh, sure, sure. You know, he behaved badly. He was sometimes a craven, opportunistic man. He was often opportunistic. And he lied. Even then he lied. He told Eleanor, he got her to stay with him by saying, I'll never see Lucy again. And he did. He even involved his children in it. His daughter, Anna, had Lucy at the White House when Eleanor was gone. Lucy was there when he had his aneurysm and died. She was there, and they had to hustle her out, and it broke Eleanor's heart. She was so furious when she found out that he had all these years deceived her. It was despicable. His daughter had her, though, come to the White House because her father was so lonely. And even Eleanor, it's a very sad story, because after he dies, Eleanor is furious and heartbroken and deceived and betrayed. But she begins to say to herself, I shouldn't have been so hard-hearted toward him. He was so lonely. And that's what his daughter said. He was so alone. And Eleanor was never there. She was in many ways the more progressive, the softer-hearted woman, but she'd been so hurt in her childhood that if she was betrayed, as she was by FDR, she just never could forgive people. In some ways, she was not a very generous, warm woman, not with her children, not with her husband.
Well, she had her own extracurricular interest, didn't she?
Well, they say so, but you know, as you know, many of these things are on shaky ground. Maybe he did these things, maybe he did. Lucy, he did that. What kind of relationship he had with other women, we don't really know.
Well, not only him, but her. But Eleanor herself?
Her. Exactly. Yeah, I'm sorry I got off that. But yes, Eleanor, we don't know. She uses very, what we consider romantic language when she talks to some of these women. And also, she was very fond of one of her bodyguards. And she might have had some kind of, but we don't really know, some kind of relationship. But we don't know that she wasn't just talking in a kind of fond way that was much more common when she was a young girl in Victorian times than it would be to us. It sounds very odd to us. We don't really know what they did.
Now, one of the things that cost Adlai Stevenson his election was the fact, besides the hole in his shoe, was the fact that he had been a divorced man. So divorce in FDR's day, a lot different than divorce by the multi-divorce Trump, right? I mean, thinking in terms of a timeline, divorce was a crippler in those days.
Yes, and I think that's what was in everybody's mind. I think early on he knew he had a chance to be president. Everybody knew it. Many people would make reference to that sense of destiny they had around him. He was an ambitious man. I think that's probably the reason that he didn't go with Lucy. But the other thing you have to remember in how different the times were is that she was a Catholic. She couldn't have married him either. It was a very unwise affair, but he must have really loved that woman because he never really let her go.
When Sarah threatened Franklin, when Mama threatened Franklin for this inheritance, you're the author, I don't know this, and you've looked into this, Christine Wicker. Do you think she did it out of religious conviction, or do you think she did it out of pragmatism? She wanted to see her son succeed.
I don't know if Sarah really cared that much about the presidency. You know, she looked down on politics as beneath them. She really wanted Franklin to be like his father. I think she would have loved it if he had just come back home and been a gentleman farmer and written books. And so I don't think that she was thinking about the presidency. I think he was. I don't know. I'm sure she was appalled that he would do this, and she definitely cared what people thought of her. So when you put it all together, it's just she didn't want their name besmirched in that way. There's a story told later about how Franklin's half-brother wants to marry his longtime French mistress after his wife dies. And Sarah refuses to give him permission. And both Eleanor and Franklin were horrified that she wouldn't allow him to go on with that. But she wouldn't, because the woman was not of their class.
Christine Wicker is the author of The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. So, Germany occupied Austria in March of 1938, you say, and which we know is true. On September 26, Roosevelt sent Hitler a telegram asking for peace. When Hitler rebuffed his request, he sent a follow-up letter again urging peace. And now, in October, the Führer engineered the worst German pogrom since the Middle Ages. Okay, Kristallnacht and the Night of Broken Glass and the rest. And yet, as you indicated earlier, there are people who think that Roosevelt didn't do enough for the Jews, he didn't bomb the railways that were leading to Dachau and these other places. And his pragmatism, I think, is the thing that I find so interesting in terms of your book, the pragmatism versus the religious. You're making the argument he was a religious, simple religious guy. He went to Groton and he learned all of that stuff. But I think he was an extraordinarily pragmatic man. He knew if he did that, it was going to cost him.
He was, and that's what does make him so fascinating. He was a canny, sometimes ruthless politician. He wanted to win. He understood that it was only what you could really accomplish that mattered. And so he did what he knew he could succeed at. Now, as you know, he didn't always succeed. He didn't change the Supreme Court. He wasn't able to pack the Supreme Court. He wasn't able to oust all the conservatives.
But you know what? You know what? He won. By the time it was all over, he won. The Supreme Court was changed. People retired, and his programs went sailing through. So even there, he knew what he was doing.
Yes, he was just a consummate politician, as LBJ was. They were really good at what they did. And Eleanor hated this in him. She would leave him note after note. She would just harangue him about the things that she wanted him to do. She wanted him to do a lot more about race. She wanted him to do more for the Jews. But he would watch and see, you know, how the wind was blowing. You know, people said, he would, Claire Luce Booth said that Hitler had his salute and Roosevelt had his, but his was a finger held to the wind to see how it was blowing. So he didn't do all he could do for the Jews, but as you know, people are still really saying, did he do enough? Could he actually have done more? And the reason they didn't bomb the camps was because they would have killed Jews if they'd done that. And the reason they didn't bomb the railways was because they could end the war faster if they used their forces in other ways.
So December 7th, 1941. You know, along come the Japanese, and there's been a fierce debate for years. I've asked Doris Kearns Goodwin and so many others about this, and nobody has ever said yes. Maybe you'll be the first. But you've written a book about his simple religious principles. Did he know it was coming?
No. No, although there was some provocation, of course. We were trying to strangle Japan, cut off their oil. But no, I don't think he knew it was coming. And one of the things that was so interesting about him is his cool during that. One of the things everybody talked about was he was just so steady. He was able to make decisions. No, I don't think he saw that coming. I do think he knew that we would have to get in the war. He knew. He said in speeches a couple of times, he said, we can't survive if Japan and Germany win. He could look ahead and see that. So I think he was determined to go to war. But I think he was called a warmonger for that. You know, one of the things I say in the book is he's this peace president. People voted for him because the armament manufacturers despised him so much. And then he starts to turn, and the peacenecks and a lot of religious people were just furious and so betrayed. But he saw that we were going to have to do it. And he cast the war in religious terms. But here we go back to your point before, which is, don't all the presidents? Yes, they do. So we have to really look at how they acted. We have to look beyond their words. And if you look at what he's done, what he did, how he changed the country, people are still trying to roll back what he did. Conservatives still hate it. But what did he do for people? You know, you realize this, that we had poor houses in this country until the 50s. People who were sick or old or mentally ill, they went to horrible places where they were workhouses. And Social Security got rid of that. He created the middle class with the GI Bill. I mean, these things that he did, he saved the Dust Bowl. People just wanted to let it go. They didn't care about those losers. FDR did. And when he talked about things like the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount turns every human opportunistic value on its head. And that's what he did. He always talked about how the values of power and wealth were becoming not as important, that there were other values that Americans were coming to care more about. Now, you might say that was messianic, and I'd have to say maybe so, because that hasn't happened.
So after the Civil War, we know that Lincoln and then Johnson had a benevolent view of what should be done with the vanquished South. Obviously, FDR did not live to the end, but I think he set the strategy. Do you see anything particularly Christian in that?
Some people even say that he and Eleanor began the civil rights movement. I think there's something Christian in that.
Yes, but really in terms of how we treated Germany and Japan afterwards, he was dead.
Oh.
Yeah. So the question is, was that a Christian act?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, this is one of the things that's scaring us so much about Trump, is Trump doesn't have that moral underpinning. I didn't write this book thinking, oh, we should all be Christians. But I kept thinking to myself, well, what difference does it make if he has Christianity? I kept saying to myself, what good is religion anymore? Nobody seems to care for it. And why does it make a difference? You could be just a liberal and do these things. But if you have no spiritual consciousness, you have no underpinning for your morality, it can wave wildly. What they created after World War II, and Roosevelt was very important in doing that, was a framework that has led America to be seen as a peacemaker in the world. We've made lots of mistakes. I'm not saying that we haven't. But Trump seems to be rolling back the very things that have given us a stable world. And the thing about FDR's spirituality and all religious faith is that they see the world as interconnected. And so that causes them, even though they may be very competitive, as FDR was, and they may love power, as FDR did, they understand that we all are in this together. You know, we will hang together or we will surely hang separately.
On the other hand, you write...
He didn't say.
On the other hand, you write, he allowed firebombing of German cities, resulting in tremendous loss of civilian lives. Both these actions continued to tarnish his reputation. Controversy over his lack of action in Jewish lives, we talked about that. So that the greater good was to win the war, even though he might have to level a city. And that is not very Christian.
No. No, it's really not.
So, when you talk to groups around the country, and I know you've been traveling a lot, Christine Wicker, about your book, The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. When you travel, what are you getting back from people?
The main thing I get back is people say I didn't even know he was religious.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. People just don't even know it. It just has not been really part of his mythology that's been built up around him. And I think that's a problem, because if you take away the spiritual consciousness, the religious underpinning of what he does, what he did in this country, then it makes the programs that he has for ordinary Americans, the security net that he built for us, vulnerable. And I think that's why conservatives don't want to admit that he had any religious motivations, because then it puts those things, which are morally good things, on the same level as just any other hard-headed economic decision.
So there's the old mythology. I haven't been there, so I don't know, but politicians of the time will tell you, into the 60s and 70s, will tell you somebody would go into a West Virginia house and find three pictures on the wall: Jesus Christ, FDR, and John F. Kennedy. That puts him in sort of religious company, doesn't it?
It does. And the letters that he got were often talked about how he was chosen by God. But as you know, that is a nice thing to say. But the evangelicals are saying today that God's put Trump into office. So any time we deal with, I like to say, when we deal with religion and sex, we can't always believe what people say. So we have to try to find out, what do they do? And when we look at what Roosevelt wanted to do and what he accomplished, I don't see how you cannot see it as coming out of Judeo-Christian faith, coming out of a belief that God was in control and that we're all interrelated.
When, as I was saying before, when you travel and when you talk to groups, they didn't even know that he was Christian. What do you ascribe that to? Is it that they're just ignorant about the facts? Or is it that somehow they just can't put his actions together with religiosity?
I think he wasn't our stereotype of religion, of a religious person, particularly a Christian person. He wasn't stiff-necked. He wasn't holier than thou. He liked to have fun. He was effective. He was a great politician. He was, in many ways, very hard-headed. And so I think he just doesn't fit. I also think he wasn't a born-again. And so he didn't go around moaning about sin. He didn't repent. He didn't apologize. He was happy. He believed in himself. He was obviously an egotist. And he didn't go to church a lot. Even during that day, a lot of people thought, well, you know, where is he? Why isn't he in church every Sunday? But for me, even that spoke to the authenticity of his faith. He simply refused to go to church and have the political gain of that. He said he would do all sorts of things in the fishbowl of politics, but he would not say his prayers.
Well, but he couldn't walk into that church. He had polio. He had to be helped by his sons or other people. It could be it had nothing to do with religiosity or religion. It had to do with the fact that they went at extraordinary lengths not to show the fact that he was a cripple.
Well, that's true. But, you know, he could, what he would do when he did go to church is he would have the same thing he did when he was inaugurated, the same thing he did, you know, whenever he had to go out in public spaces, is he would have someone whose arm he would take. So he could get down the aisle. Yeah. But every time word went out that he was coming to a church, it would just be thronged with tourists, and it stopped being a religious affair, and it became a political event.
One of the things that I loved in your book, and I want to go back there for a minute, is what happened during the banking crisis. How much people had to believe in him, invest in him, almost in a religious sense, in order to take the money out from under the bed or, you know, proceed to help the government. These extraordinary stories that you tell.
Oh. I'm glad you brought that up. It was extraordinary. It was almost unbelievable. He gives his inaugural speech, and everything changes. They had machine guns up around the square while he was giving the speech. That's how perilous the times were. Eleanor said it was frightening to see how willing people were to do whatever it had to be done. Many people believed that he could have taken over the government, and some people wanted him to, but he didn't. And after his speech, they said it was like a holiday suddenly. Nobody had ever seen anything like it. Then he gives his first, in about a week, he gives his first fireside talk. And this is what you're talking about specifically. People had been hoarding gold. You know, he'd shut down the banks to stop the drain. Then he's going to open them. And before he opens them, he goes on the radio and he starts to talk to people. And the country just is transformed. When the banks open, they think there are going to be riots with people trying to get their money. Instead, people throng to give the money back to the banks. It was simply unprecedented. It was like some kind of religious revival.
He ran four times. And, of course, we have a 25th Amendment, two times, no more. Was he on bad ground as a result of that? After all, some of the later runs, the fourth term, were not that easy for him.
No. And as you know, his third term, when he decides to run for his third term, he was very cagey about that. He deceived people. Yeah. And he was very political about that. He was a very political man. And that third run, who knows? Maybe it was ego. Maybe it was some kind of idea that only he could lead the country. He engineered the election so that it seemed like he was elected by some great acclaim when that hadn't really happened. He deceived some people who really thought he was going to support them for president, and then he supported himself. In his last run during the war, I think he probably really did want to retire, but he was afraid to. He felt like he had to, you know, he had to stay there. He had to stay the course. And he was very ill. And he did something very duplicitous during that election. In the election before, people had worried about his health, and so he'd done this great parade route through New York and let people see him, and he looked good. So he decided he would do it before the fourth election. But in order to do that, it was very cold and it was rainy, and he gave an incredible, you know, hours long. He stayed in this open car and was soaked and continued to wave to people and looked great. But in fact, he had places where the car pulled off. He was taken into this, set next to heaters, dried off. His clothes were changed. He was massaged. He was warmed up and then put back in the car and put out. So he deliberately deceived people.
I only have one minute
sorry,
to go.
Probably not.
Christine Wicker, I only have 1 minute to go. I wanted to ask you something. Moses was punished for the golden calf, you know, the idol, by God. Do you think FDR might have been punished for anything?
Well, if God intended him to be president, and if God allowed him to get polio and be crippled, you could wonder, if you have that kind of theology.
Well, Moses couldn't speak very well, as we know.
Yeah,
had to have Aaron doing all that for him. So I suppose one could make the argument God puts, you know, people into unfortunate situations in order to have the best in them come out. Who knows? Anyway, Christine Wicker, we're out of time. Christine Wicker's book is The Simple Faith of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Religion's Role in the FDR Presidency. Christine, thank you so much for spending all of this time with us. I very much enjoyed it, and I hope you did too.
I really did. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.